Hello and welcome back to the Shakespeare Birthday Party. I'm Danny Fitzpatrick.
And I'm Grace Fitzpatrick.
And today we're going to be talking a little bit about Pericles of Tyre. So we'll begin with a brief summary. And it is a play that involves a horrible amount of bad luck on the part of Pericles, who, as the Prince of Tyre, sails to attempt to marry the daughter of King Antiochus, or Antiochus. Now, to marry said daughter, he is set a riddle, which has been put to all the other suitors prior, and whoever solves the riddle gets to marry the daughter. Pericles is given the riddle, and he understands that what the riddle means is that Antiochus and his daughter have an incestuous relationship. So Pericles says to himself, well, this is a tight spot, because if I solve the riddle, then I'm going to die, because they're going to kill me for knowing the truth. And if I don't solve the riddle, they're going to kill me, because I didn't solve the riddle. So he basically stalls for time, runs away. Antiochus sends an assassin after him to try to kill him. So when he returns to Tyre, his advisors tell him, you should probably run away because this guy is coming to kill you. So he flees. As he is fleeing, he is shipwrecked and washes up on the shore. And in the land where he washes up, he kind of happens upon a series of jousts and other games that are being played in order to marry another princess, Thaisa. He succeeds in the jousting. He marries her and stays in the court of her father for a little while. And then he gets a messenger from Tyre saying, you should come back because your friend Helicanus has had the crown of Tyre pushed upon him, and he has said that he wants to wait another year before he actually takes the crown in case you turn back up. And so that time is almost up. You need to come back. So Pericles does that. His wife is now pregnant, and on the journey back to Tyre, she is thought to have died in childbirth. Her body is put in a wooden box, basically a casket, and tossed overboard. So just another stage in the horrible bad luck for Pericles. Pericles leaves his daughter Marina in the care of a couple. She grows up with this couple. The mother in the couple becomes upset because Marina is sort of more beautiful, sort of outshines her own daughter. So she comes up with a plot to have Marina killed. The murderer takes Marina for a walk. Some pirates fortuitously show up and carry Marina off and sell her into a brothel. Now, she is so virtuous that she is converting the customers of the brothel to a more virtuous, holy way of life, and so this, of course, is very bad business for a brothel, and so she is going to be deflowered, and she prays to Diana, and she gets assistance from Diana. Eventually, she is reunited with her father, Pericles, who has understandably been in a horrible malaise for quite some time now, thinking that not only has his wife died, but his daughter, who he left in the care of trusted people, is also dead. So the two are reunited. Diana comes to Pericles in a dream and tells him to go to her temple and offer sacrifices there, which he does. And it turns out that his wife was not dead, in fact, but has been a Vestal virgin of Diana for all this time. And so the whole family is reunited. And so that is basically the wild story of Pericles of Tyre. A couple of formally sort of interesting points about the play. The chorus is played by a figure, John Gower, a poet from whom Shakespeare got a lot of the sort of plot for this play. It's also interesting to kind of try to figure out what hand Shakespeare had in the play that has come down to us. We know that this was one of the most popular plays of the time. It was performed very often, which of course it is not now. It's very rarely seen. But there are a lot of kind of strange things about the text. So after about the midway point, the text that we have gets much more high quality. Has much more of an authentic Shakespeare feel, whereas a lot of the kind of earlier points in the play just seem odd. There's a lot of sort of random rhyming that takes place throughout scenes, throughout acts, and so it's thought that perhaps there was kind of a pirating event that happened in which spectators possibly wrote down very hastily portions of the play as it was performed. Those are kind of some of the formal characteristics of it. And Grace, I don't know if you want to take it from there.
Well, I mean, just the potential for it being a pirated play, I think, is probably my favorite thing I've learned about this play. I think that's fantastic. And it sort of matches the stormy qualities of the play itself. You know, it's a very, very wild, kind of windswept, just ripping story. So I think, especially since it was such a popular play at the time, I really want to believe that it was pirated, and that's why it's kind of a strange structure or lack thereof. But I have no doubt that Shakespeare definitely, at least played a significant role in the formation of this play, just because you just see like all the little trademark Shakespeare details. I love that this is a story where he plays with ancient themes, which I know we've talked about before. You know, why didn't he do more of that? I guess there's Julius Caesar, but I don't know. I've always wondered why he didn't dip more into the like ancient style.
Mm-hmm.
But even at the same time, you know, he has these things, like especially with the chorus, but the play is still, I think, characteristically British. So, you know, you don't have a chorus like you would in an ancient Greek play. It's Gower. Then what were some other ones? I jotted down a couple. There's the kind of trademark Shakespearean sauciness, like with the story of the incestuous relationship at the beginning, and then kind of the goofy, at least I read it as like goofy, kind of foolish banter with the bawd and all the other characters in the brothel. He plays around with the idea of Deus Ex Machina with Diana showing up and kind of setting Pericles up for success at the end, just at the right time. And he's got kind of a biblical playfulness. Like, there is definitely a biblical knowledge, which he would have been, you know, he would have been very well aware of the Bible, very well versed. But I just couldn't help but think of like the story of Jonah, where there's the line where it says that Tisa's body has been, her body inside the casket has been belched up from the water, just like Jonah would have been belched up by a whale. And then after Pericles kind of understands his tragic circumstances, he takes like this quasi-Nazarite vow and is like, well, I'm just never going to cut my hair ever again. For decades, well, I guess 14 years in the play. But it's kind of like a sackcloth and ashes thing more than an actual Nazarite vow. But these like biblical details are things that are just reminiscent of the Bible for me. They're not meant to be, I don't think, like an allegory or anything like that. I think it's just more Shakespeare's like playful artistic flair. Just kind of dipping in and out of different traditions. So I thought that was just wonderful. So I don't know if you have any thoughts on that or anything else.
Yeah, no, it's definitely very interesting with a lot of the kind of Jonah comparisons. Like we go to Tarsus in this play. Yeah, there's also that kind of like St. Paul sense of just like St. Paul talks about all the things he's endured, just like stonings and shipwrecks and all these kinds of things, which I think are very very similar to a lot of what Pericles undergoes in this play.
This doesn't really go with St. Paul, because St. Paul is a very, like, aggressive kind of figure, very assertive, I think.
Yeah.
But we were talking a little while ago about how Pericles, like, he seems to be a good and noble man, but he's also, like, a very passive hero on the play. A lot of these things just sort of happen to him. And he's still very obviously trying to do the right things throughout the play.
Yeah.
But he just, he has a knack for being struck with just really bad fortune. I mean, you just think about like that first scene at the beginning where the guy's just trying to marry a princess. Like he's just, he thinks he's, you know, going to have a completely normal interaction, and all of a sudden it's like, no, actually you've walked right into the Crebo Depot and I am the king. It's just not good. Like, what are the chances of that? I don't know. Maybe there are more chances of that in the ancient world, but
maybe.
I would like to think that was unusual. Pericles definitely seemed to be freaked out by it.
Yeah,
so
he was very disturbed.
So that's good.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's kind of a strange, kind of an unexpected hero for an ancient play. He's not like a chest beating mega warrior or anything like that, which there's nothing, not that there's anything wrong with that. But yeah, I just thought that was surprising.
Yeah, there's definitely not the, I mean, it's interesting because it's very reminiscent of the Odyssey in certain ways, but there's not that kind of Odyssean warrior element to it, as you say.
Yeah, like I wouldn't think of Pericles as like almost, I don't know, as godlike as Odysseus.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a different kind of man.
For sure.
Yeah. Something I wanted to ask your thoughts about. Just thinking about how, I don't know, with the possibility of this being a pirated edition of a Shakespeare play, but then also how Shakespeare acknowledges that he used Gower as a reference pretty strongly for this story. I don't know, it just got me thinking about just the nature of art and kind of ethical usage of other people's art to make new art. Because obviously, you know, we need materials to make anything.
Sure.
And you're not actually going to make anything original when it comes to good art. So, like, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that's so interesting about Shakespeare just in general is that so little of it is original. in a mm-hmm. lot of ways. Like he's, like we've talked about how basically the Tempest is the only, is his only plot that is his alone.
Yeah.
And so I think there's, I know when I first learned that about Shakespeare, like kind of as a high school student, I remember feeling kind of disappointed that that he borrowed as much as he did. But I think there's also something that kind of speaks to, I think there's a very deep kind of Shakespearean humility involved in his art, where, and I don't know, I could be totally wrong about this, but my sense is that Shakespeare did not care all that much about being the world's greatest poet or anything.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of get the sense of just like, this guy just liked writing poetry, and
he could laugh at himself.
So I think there's, and I think there's an enormous sense today of focusing on the self as kind of over against everybody else and everything else, and trying in artistic expression to perfectly express the self rather than relying on anything outside, which I think Shakespeare is very counter to.
Yeah, he seems to be. No, that's a really, really good point. It's almost as if he's less self-assertive, like less Shakespeare-assertive, I guess,
mm-hmm.
and more about kind of, I don't know if this is a good way to say it. He's more about like the connected, like spiritual connective tissue,
mm-hmm.
I guess, amongst people.
Yeah.
And he's really got a hold on that, because
yeah.
he's still popular today, obviously.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
Thank
I
you.
Like that. Yeah. Sorry, I'm just thinking about it.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Another point I wanted to bring up, and this is another thing where I'm going to be struggling with my words, with how to express it, but I do think it's worth thinking about, is just like, I love his artistry at the beginning of the play and the end of the play, and I think just from a like director's standpoint could be
mm-hmm.
a lot of fun to kind of shape the look of this on the stage.
Mm-hmm.
So if I remember correctly, Antiochus has, when like he presents his daughter at the time of the riddle.
Yeah.
And I think she like comes forward and is dressed as a bride.
Mm-hmm.
So she's got this very like pure, innocent, just like good appearance.
Mm-hmm.
But then we find out like there's a whole other like weird underbelly situation going on. So I think like that's just a really cool contrast that you could have, like a visual way of conveying just the utter horror of the situation.
Mm-hmm.
And then towards the end of the play, when Pericles is on board his ship and he's just like covered in all the hair that he hasn't trimmed in the past however many years, not looking too good, and then they bring Marina on to try to talk him out of this deep existential funk.
Yeah.
And so she's still, even though the brothel people have given up on making her into a prostitute, and they're just letting her practice sewing, and it's like sewing and music, just like what Alistair McIntyre would call like female practices or feminine practices.
Yeah.
So, and then just like letting her talk to people, I guess. But at the same time, she's still owned literally by the Vaude. So I would like to think that, you know, from a director's standpoint, you know, she would not be dressed like a bride. She would be dressed either in common clothing or, you know, something very unimpressive, just to kind of like make that contrast between her current like social situation in life, and then kind of allow like the purity and goodness of her words to shine in that moment. And if I remember, I don't know, I don't remember if Antiochus's daughter speaks at all, or if she's just...
I think she does a little bit.
A little bit? Okay. Yeah. I'm sure she doesn't say anything important. She might as well not speak. But, but yeah, I just thought that was such a cool way to, like, to start and then end, with Pericles being presented with, you know, a young woman, and then her true character kind of coming out after a little bit.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just thought that was a cool little...
Yeah, for sure.
Little piece of artistry there.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Is there any, like, particular part of the play that you really enjoyed or that really stood out to you?
Yeah, I really... well, I think it's just, like, it's kind of a... I think it's a very good study in a lot of ways of just, like, the... Like, it's very Hollywood in a sense of just, like, constantly finding new ways to beat your character down and just, like, make them fail over and over and over again. Like, when we were... I was thinking about this when we were watching Monsters University the other night, where, like, they... Like, it's just, like, you know, they make Mike Wazowski fail like over and over and over again, where like, you know, like you think like he's never gonna make it into the SCARE program, and then he makes it in the SCARE program, and then he's out of the SCARE program, and Dean Hardscrabble is like, well, you gotta you gotta overcome these impossible odds and you can get back in the SCARE program, but then you're still not scary. But then you can, you know, you think you've done it and you've beaten the odds and you've defeated Roar in the in the scary games or whatever, but then it turns out that you cheated unbeknownst to you, and so now you have to find a new way to do this, and so you go try to scare an actual child, but you can't do it, but then you have to find a way to overcome that. And I think this play is very, very much like that, where like the film industry today is just very good at figuring out like what are those ways that our protagonist can fail as many times as possible in the course of a film, and I think it's very similar with Pericles in a lot of ways, where it's like, how can another thing possibly go wrong for this guy?
Yeah,
but it does.
Yeah, Pericles and Mike Wazowski are
basically
the same person at
pretty
this
much.
Point. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, that's really cool. I'm trying to think, what was this character's name? I don't remember. But the, I don't know, just kind of like the... He comes across as like a giant hippie who saves Tyus's life.
Oh, yeah.
I forget what his name is. But I really liked his character. And it's interesting too, like, how that all came about, because, you know, you talk about all these different circumstances that just knock down the protagonist, and it seems like something like Tyus's supposed death was just like completely avoidable, because the sailors were just like so insistent, like, she's dead, she's absolutely dead, there's nothing we can do about it, and you need to just lock her up in a box, throw her over the side, because, you know, she's absolutely just not respirating anymore. And she clearly was respirating, so it just makes me wonder, like, what is going on in that scene. But there isn't really, like, a reason given aside from just, like, these sailors and their superstitions.
Yeah.
And they just are very insistent. And it's a very, you know, again, Jonah-ish kind of circumstance. So, yeah, it's funny how there does seem to be a variety of ways in which Pericles gets struck down, whether it's just by, like, dumb luck or the flaws of... the flawed opinion, medical opinions of other men, or, you know, possibly there's some divine influence there.
Yeah,
so it's just he's getting beaten down from all sides for sure.
Oh yeah, he's having a tough time.
Yeah.
Alrighty, well, we will wrap it up there, and next time, since we're getting into the middle of summer, we'll go ahead and do Midsummer Night's Dream. Until then, let the party continue.
Party on, Wayne.
Party on, Garth. All right, goodbye.